You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like. You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
This is Michael Gineau with Insight to Israel, brought to you by America's Web Radio. And I want to thank the guys at America's Web Radio for bringing the truth of the Jewish state to the grassroots of the United States of America. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. You have been through good times and bad, more good than bad, thank God. You have been committed to bringing this message to the American people, and they want it. The American people want to know the truth about what happens in the Jewish state as it leads the world as number one in technology, agriculture, medicine, and the vast amounts of humanitarian work they do around the world. It is amazing. So, and thank you to all the listeners. Insight to Israel is in the top 20% out of 26,000 radio shows in less than a year. And we have worked very hard to make this happen, to get this message to you. A lot of long hours, a lot of sitting on the internet and just promoting Insight to Israel. So thank you to those who are listening to the radio show. Also want to thank Americans at the grassroots level for giving to Hershey's for Heroes. If you don't know what Hershey's for Heroes is, you should Google Hershey's for Heroes or do it on Facebook. It is where Americans are sending thousands of chocolate bars with a note on each one to the Israeli soldiers, thanking them for defending the Jewish state. Thank you for defending Israel. We love you. We pray for you. We stand with you. The simple note, when these soldiers see it, I travel all over the country. I get on the bases here. I have a fantastic relationship with one of the greatest militaries. And as soon as those soldiers see that note, I'll tell you, it is amazing how it changes their morale. When you hear from the leftist media and global governance how evil and wicked Israel is, this is an amazing country, and it's amazing, the propaganda machine. But with that being said, thank you, America, for standing with the Jewish state and showing your love for the soldiers. Now, moving forward, I am here in the beautiful city. So, I have, I want to say, Dr. Michael
Widlansky.
Widlansky. Dr. Widlansky, I'm going to say Michael because you keep telling me to say Michael.
That's fine.
Sir, it is a beautiful day in Emek.
Emek Lefaim. In Hebrew, it means Ghost Valley.
Ghost Valley. Well, I'll tell you, this is certainly, I don't know if it's in a valley, but it's certainly not a ghost town, that's for sure.
That's for sure. I think they gave it the name Emek Lefaim, Ghost Valley, when Jerusalem is a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And then this part of town, or wasn't yet a part of town, was basically the road from Jerusalem down to Bethlehem and Hebron. So it was kind of deserted, the outskirts. But thank God today the ghosts have gone away, and it's a beautiful sunny day in Jerusalem.
Oh,
or as we call it, Jerusalem, D.C. Jerusalem, David's capital.
Wow, I've never heard it said like that before.
It's not my idea. I won't take credit for it. I originally got the idea from Ambassador Yehuda Avner, who was the associate of several Israeli prime ministers, primarily Prime Minister Menachem Begin. It's his bon mot, his good word, and I think it's a wonderful thing to spread.
No, absolutely, absolutely. You know, I'm glad you mentioned Menachem Begin. I read a very amazing quote by him just the other day. I made a video and posted it on YouTube about the Holocaust Memorial Day. And I played, actually, I took a video of the Israeli flag flying for 3 minutes. And with that video, I posted the first uncovered singing of Hatikva by some prisoners. The BBC put it out years ago. It came out like 30 years after the Holocaust. Prisoners from a camp.
Death camp.
Death camp that were singing Hatikva.
Sure.
And I put that quote at the end of the video where he says, we don't need other countries to, basically I'm paraphrasing, we don't need other countries to acknowledge our right to existence, to exist.
He was very, very, he said, Israel exists not by virtue of power, but by the power of virtue.
Wow. Say it again.
Israel exists. This is Begin's word.
Wow.
Lo bezchut hakoach, ala bechoach hazchut. In Hebrew, that means we exist by, not by the virtue of power, but by the power of virtue.
Wow. That's powerful.
That is powerful.
That's amazing. Some of the stuff, I'll tell you what, I think that in the almost 2 years that I've been here, I've read more history. I've known a lot of history. Some people are shocked at the history I do know. It doesn't take a lot, but when you talk to an Israeli-born Jew, as an American or an outsider, when you say you know who the Palmach and the Haganah and Edsel and Lehi, you know who they are, and you know about the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth Aliyah, they don't expect anyone but Jewish people to know that. And they've even told me, you know more about Israel's history than some Jews today.
Unfortunately, because we're already a 66-year-old state, sometimes people tend to forget the history. But I hope that we will continue in God's way and be strong enough.
Absolutely.
So that even a few hundred years down the line, we'll be as strong in our regard of Israeli history as we are in remembering the Passover Seder.
Wow.
In remembering the Exodus from Egypt.
Wow.
You know, there's a story about that, and maybe Yoram told you, our friend Yoram Ettinger.
Yes, he's a regular on the show.
Yeah, and Yoram has a story how Ben-Gurion met, I think it was Eisenhower for the first time, and Eisenhower quipped, well, you think you guys know history, and Ben-Gurion said, you know, if you go around the children of the United States and you ask them who was on the Mayflower, they won't know.
No.
But if you go to the children of Israel, you will find out that they remember Moses, Miriam, and that happened 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Because we teach it every year, over and over again, as if we left Egypt today. And that's a very strong story.
Wow. And you know what, sir? While we were off air, I want to say that my soul was refreshed speaking to you. I want to thank former Ambassador Yoram Ettinger for bringing us together.
He's a good buddy.
And I'm thankful for the amazing people I've met. Now, let's listen.
You don't know where to start.
No, I do. I know what I want to say. My first question is this. You'll always be... You were born... Let me tell you my perspective.
Okay.
You were born in the United States. Thank God.
Okay.
You were formerly an American citizen, but now a citizen of your homeland, rightfully so.
But I'm also still an American citizen.
Okay, okay.
And I'm very proud of my American roots.
Right.
And I think that America has been the greatest contribution to the modern world.
Absolutely.
And I think the two greatest countries in the world are America and Israel, and that's why they are hated.
Right.
By the forces of extremism and despotism and hatred, because they are both countries of ideas. They are countries that don't say, ah, I'm American because I speak American, or I'm white, or I'm yellow, or I'm black,
right,
or I'm Israeli and I speak Israeli. No, you can be an American and speak all kinds of languages,
right,
but you have the fundamental truths of the constitutional process to be a free state, to be a land that's open to people who want to be free,
right,
as John Kennedy called it, a nation of immigrants, people who come in and work to be better, and that's what Israel is. is, a nation of immigrants,
yeah,
people who want to be a free state in the Middle East. And as America has been a shining example for the world, Israel is a shining example for the world.
Right.
And both of them take as their root the words of Isaiah, that from Zion shall go forth Torah or learning or an example to the rest of the world, to light up the rest of the world. We show by example. We don't get in your face. We succeed, and then people say, hey, how did they succeed? Maybe we should look at what they're doing.
Right.
That's the way to teach.
Right. Wow, wow. You know, two things on that. When I was in Romania teaching school, I used to say, I can be Romanian. I can be an American and come to Romania and never be a Romanian. I can go to China and never be a Chinaman. I can go to France and never be a Frenchman, but they can all come to the United States and be an American.
Absolutely.
And that's the wonderful thing. And I, you know, and for the listeners, you if you listen to the show on a regular basis, you've probably heard me say this, but the reality of American history is, as you and I have stated, as we shared, if it had not been for the Jewish people receiving Torah or the Pentateuch in Christianity or the Torah and the prophets from God at Mount Sinai, I would not have a Constitution or Bill of Rights.
That's right. That's right. As we spoke about it earlier, the fact is that the founding fathers were inspired by the Hebrew Bible. They saw, Benjamin Franklin thought that the flag of the United States should be either the Ten Commandments or the splitting of the sea.
Wow.
And all the founding fathers went to universities where the valedictory address was in Hebrew. That is, when they had a commencement address, graduated every year at Harvard, at Columbia, that was called King's College, or at Yale, which still has the priestly blessing as its motto, the Urim v'Tumim, the blessing, the breastplate of Aaron.
Wow.
They looked at the Hebrew Bible that said, man does not rule man. God rules man.
Right.
Man is free, and he worships God by choice. And we all worship in different ways, but we have several strong basic values that are incorporated in the Ten Commandments and other places. Love thy neighbor as thyself. These are eternal truths, but they came down in the Hebrew Bible. They've come down to Christianity.
Right.
And
right.
Even some of them have come down to good Muslims and to other faiths. And it's very important. And that's why Americans, from the very beginning, saw themselves as the new Israel.
Right.
And to a certain extent, Israel is the new America in the Middle East.
Right, I agree with you.
And that's why people like Ayatollah Khomeini and others view America and Israel as the big Satan and the little Satan.
Right.
That's why Bin Laden said the same thing. The fact is that by America's very success and Israel's very success, they get people angry who tried to succeed by despotism and dictatorship and couldn't do it.
Right.
And need to make excuses. But the truth is, we don't have a monopoly on goodness. Try our methods. Come along with us. We're not trying to force them on you. We'll be glad. You don't want to go to a McDonald's? Don't go to a McDonald's. Whatever. You want to do whatever you want to do. Do whatever you want to do. We're not going to get in your face. We're going to show you by example, which, by the way, was the method of Abraham. Our tent is open.
Right.
You can come in and go on your way.
Right. Wow. Wow. That's great stuff, sir. That's awesome. Awesome. I mean, okay, we're going to get to you, who you are as a man. Where are you from in the United States?
Well, I've come from the west side to the West Bank. I came from the west side of Manhattan to Jerusalem, and my father was born in a place that was on the border between Lithuania and Poland, Vilna, that was the Talmudic center of European Jewry, and my mother was born in New Jersey, lived a lot of her life in Brooklyn, and they met through radio, by the way.
Wow.
My mother was a broadcaster on Yiddish radio in the United States. My father came as an immigrant to the United States, lived in the Bronx.
Wow.
Went to night school and heard my mother's radio broadcast in Yiddish, fell in love with her voice. She used to do the news program in Yiddish, and he went down to the studio to meet her.
Wow.
So I'm a product of radio.
Hey, now, let me say this. My mother listens to the radio show, and she told me one time, she goes, Michael, you say wow a lot. I said, Mother, sit here across from great people that I have the blessing to interview, and you can't find any other word but wow, and that is a wow.
It's a wow story, but it's true.
Right.
When I met my wife, when I came to Israel, we had a couple mutual friends. I didn't go on very many blind dates in my life. I think maybe three or four. But one of the girls I went out with on a blind date said, you're on your way to Israel. I have a friend I want you to meet there. And I went to Israel via Egypt, where I was on a fellowship program for 6 months.
Yeah.
When I finally got to Israel, I'd already been in Israel for about a year, and I'd been in the Israeli army, and I was in Israeli army radio. And my friend got in touch. My friend got in touch with my future wife, Sarah, and said, there's a guy from America you really have to see, and he's a nice guy. And you should be all right because you both speak Hebrew, you both speak English, and you both speak Arabic. So you should be able to work out all your differences.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a great story. Let me ask you, okay, so first of all, is your wife...
She's Israeli born. She was born here in Israel.
Now that's, sir, that's a blessing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a blessing.
Every time I have trouble finding a Hebrew word in the crossword puzzle, I know where to go.
So okay, we're gonna get to this in the next segment. I'm sitting here looking at a book called Battle for Our Minds. Now, you're a much smarter man than I am.
I don't think that for a minute.
Okay, you may not acknowledge that. I'm acknowledging. Because, now, there's two things that make a man intelligent. Common sense, experience. Let me throw in the third, I apologize. And education. Where did you go to school at? What, first of all, what was life like for you growing up?
I grew up in New York City. And I went to a Jewish day school which had a double curriculum. We went to school from about 8:30 to 5:30 in the evening.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd do English, math, and all the other things. And then we'd also do the Hebrew subjects in Hebrew, prophets, Torah,
wow.
Talmud, Hebrew itself. And, you know, American history, world history, all of that.
You know a lot of American history. You and Yoel Medinger both.
That's right.
Know more American history than most Americans put together.
Well, I think the key to knowing is to never stop learning.
Right.
And to never think you know everything.
That's, there you go.
That's it. You know, the Talmud has a beautiful saying. It asks, who is the wealthy man, who is the wise man, who is the rich man, who is the respected man? On the wise man, it says, who is the wise man? He who learns from every man.
Right.
And that's really it. If you have the emotional intelligence and the modesty to say, I don't know everything. Mr. Smith can teach me something. Mrs. Jones can teach me something. Then you're on your way to being smart.
And powerful.
That's also true.
That's why Solomon asked for wisdom and not all the other things, because they were gained through wisdom.
That's right. That's exactly correct. And I grew up with this double curriculum, which gave me already at a fairly early age two languages and eventually three languages, four languages. And then I went to Columbia University.
And that was for your undergrad.
I did undergrad, then I did a master's at Columbia in international affairs, and I did a post-master's certificate in Middle East studies. We had to get other other languages also for there. So I have a smattering of languages, which are good, very good. As you and I have discussed, if you want to be in international affairs, you have to know other cultures.
Right.
Because if you're not speaking their language,
you're killing me.
You're kissing through tissue paper.
You're killing me, because my Hebrew is bad, and I've been here almost 2 years.
But you have the key, which first of all is, you got a nice smile.
Thanks.
And people will talk to you if you got a nice smile. And you're willing to learn and speak.
Yeah.
And they'll correct you a little bit, but they'll live with what you're saying. And you'll pick up. You're not be shy. And that's the way to learn.
And you know, people respect you when you try, even if you
absolutely.
Fail.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially here.
Yeah. People here are, you know, I know I've probably said this 1,000 times in our conversation that we had prior, but, and if you're listening to the show, I want to encourage you, if you ever have the opportunity to come to this amazing, amazing country, if you've seen my Facebook page, you know, there's some people that tell me, Michael, you're smiling all the time. You're smiling. Sir, I've never felt, and I'm 43, and have never in my life have felt such fulfillment and purpose as I do now. And I thank God for that. And if you want fulfillment and purpose, even if for 2 weeks, which will start you on the road to having an understanding of what real principles and God's land really is, you can't leave here if you have a good moral conscience and a compass and not want to do something for Israel.
That's right.
I love this atmosphere here. This great country.
I love it. This is a country where people live by their horns.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's actually worse in other parts of the Middle East. People just are in love with their horns. If you've ever lived in Lebanon or Egypt, believe me. They lean on the horns and they don't leave them.
It's a small sense of authoritarianship. So, okay, so you went, how long did it take you to finish up all this work to get where you are as far as your education?
Well, I did 3 degrees in 6 years.
Wow, great.
And then I was going to Egypt for my fellowship where I got another degree in advanced Arabic.
How old were you at that time?
I was 24, 25.
Okay.
And along the way, I'd gotten injured. I'd hurt my leg. I was used to run long. You won't believe this, Michael, looking at me, but I used to run long distance. I used to run a half marathon every other day.
Nice.
I used to run in Manhattan at night, usually at night.
When did you save us?
Yeah, well, it was, you don't want all the car fumes.
Right.
And there's only so many times you can run around Central Park. And I would run from Central Park West and 69th Street up to the George Washington Bridge along the Hudson River.
Wow.
And then run back. And, of course, you're right. You're going through parts of Harlem and some dangerous neighborhoods. But that's all right. There's nothing as fast as a Jew scared. I didn't have any problems. It was fine.
Right. That was hilarious. So you finish up all this education. That was good. You finish up all your education. You are in Egypt, and you make Aliyah, which Aliyah is a coming home of the Jews.
Right. You know, there's a special poignancy for a Jew to come to Israel, Aliyah, to go up from Egypt to Israel. That's the way Moses and Joshua led the people, and it was very special for me coming out of Egypt on the first direct plane flight after peace in January 1980, and I'm very happy I came. I feel I love America,
right.
But I feel especially fulfilled in Israel, and I think anybody who lives here feels the sense of family that you have inside the community and the love of children and the respect for the elderly. And these are special qualities that you don't always get in other Western countries.
You're right. You know, right now, sir, you can't do it. I challenge anyone in the United States to show me where. But I walk through the majority of this country, and it's amazing. I can see, after school, packs of grade school children walking the streets by themselves, no adults, laughing, playing, talking. I see it here. Even
and you're not worried about swarms. You're not worried about kids going through one of these malls and doing anything bad. They're all having a good time but not doing anything wrong.
Right. No, it's amazing. I know people that live in Efrat that their kids, young teenagers, will go off to the Dead Sea and go camping for a weekend. Get on the bus with a group of kids. And no, I have to tell you, some people send me emails and say, you think Israel's perfect. I'm like, no, I don't. But you know what? You're behind the United States as far as cultural corruption. I think at least 10 years, maybe more. I don't know how you view it, and I'm only a novice here. I've only been here for almost 2 years, but I have learned a lot. And, of course, you have every country has drugs or pornography or things like that, but these are things that I don't see that are prominent in most of the country.
That's right. People look down at drugs. I think we have a drinking problem. I think the West has a drinking problem.
Right.
And I think some of that's been imported. I mean, people see the binge drinking in the United States.
Yep.
Also, we've had a tremendous immigration flow from Russia, and there's a drinking problem in Eastern Europe.
Right.
And we have a lot of kids who think that it's the newest thing when they're 17, 18 years old to drink a lot. I can only tell you that with my kids, we teach them that you can have Kiddush wine, the Sabbath wine,
right?
And that now they're all over 18, they're all over 21. They understand that, first of all, you don't drink by yourself.
Right.
It's like swimming. You don't go by yourself. So that if you get into trouble, somebody can take care of you.
Right.
Secondly, and I heard this from a friend of mine, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, made a very good... He says, a Jew doesn't drink to get high. You get high, and then you have a drink.
Right, wow.
So if you're already happy, then you can have a drink. If you're at a wedding, or if you're at a Sabbath celebration, a festival celebration, and you have a drink, have a lot of peanuts first. Make sure that the alcohol disperses slowly. Don't go crazy. That's fine. Have a glass of red wine, that's also fine. White wine, that's fine. If you're like me and you like bourbon, I like bourbon. I have my one bourbon, then I'll wait 2 hours for the second bourbon. And we don't go crazy.
Right.
If you can enjoy the drinking and not use it as an escape, that's fine.
Wow. So how many children do you have?
We have three boys, my wife Sarah and I. Our boys are Daniel, Jonathan, we call him Yoni, and Elad.
Like Jonathan Netanyahu.
That's right. The boys all have biblical names, and my wife has a biblical name. And people say, who wears the pants in the family? I say, I'm just like Abraham. God said to Abraham, and your wife Sarah, listen to what she tells you.
So your kids are all grown.
That's right.
And they have families?
Not yet. They're all in the in-between stage.
Right.
They've all, the two oldest boys have graduated college. Daniel's doing law school now. Yoni is doing graphic arts, his second degree. And Elad is still at Hebrew University in his first degree. There are lots of girls around. We'll know it's serious when we see one on a repetitive level.
Right, exactly. Wow. So that's got to make you proud that you've come home and now you can raise your children in such an amazing environment.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm very pleased with our kids. Sure, they disappoint me sometimes and I disappoint them sometimes.
Right.
But we listen to each other. We have fantastic discussions, not just about Bible. We discuss music, the latest things in rock, latest things in jazz. My kids just discovered Claude Bowling, the French jazz guy, or Frank Sinatra, that American kid that I introduced them to, or some of the Beatles stuff, and they'll say, Dad, did you hear this song? And then they'll play me Michel or something from the Beatles, or they'll play me something from Claude Bowling. And I said, didn't I introduce you to that? And they say, not this one. And they'll show me this. And they'll
say, that's awesome. Well, you know what, sir? We got a great first half.
My pleasure.
This has been great. We're going to talk about serious work that you're doing.
All right.
And I think it's serious. I think it's great and informative. So we'll be right back. This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Thank you for listening. This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory. Ladies serving 2 years and men serving 3 right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gano. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
You're listening to America's Web Radio, your voice in the matter.
I'm 20 years old, officer is 25 years old, 30 years old, Israel is 66 years old, and it's dramatically changed since the time I first visited here when I was 14 in 1968.
Wow.
I remember just how unbuilt up it was, and it had already gotten a lot bigger. Today, you see modern superhighways. It used to be that you would go from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem over, some of the roads were dirt. Today you go from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, if you're not in a traffic jam,
you can
do it in about 35, 40 minutes. And if you've got these amazing tunnels and great routes.
Amazing.
Beautiful. And you got really nice highways. You've got good trains. Sure, we've got more work to do. But you know something? Driving around Israel most of the time is better than driving around New York or New Jersey.
Right.
Or
Washington, D.C.
That's right, and even California. We were talking earlier. I was teaching this past semester at the University of California at Irvine as a visiting professor, and I was thinking of driving every day from Los Angeles to Irvine, and people said, no, don't do it. I said, but it's only an hour away. They said, yeah, it's an hour away till you have to do it. And then you find out that the hour is 4 hours in each direction. And I said, okay, I get you.
You know, I want to say that a lot of my friends here, they have cars. And sometimes I'll call them up and I'll say, can you help me find the bus route or find what bus number I need to take? They're like, we don't ride the bus. We don't know how to do that. And that's understandable. As an American who, I love my freedom of the car, it gives you freedom.
That's right.
I have to say that I love to ride the bus. I'm a bus guy.
Well, that's the way I grew up also, because in New York City, when you grow up in New York City, you have two legs, a subway token, today you have a Metro card, and you could bicycle. But that's the basic of the way I used to go to school, either bus, subway, bicycle, or walking, because you don't want to have to deal with the parking problem.
Right.
Now, Israel's getting a bit of a parking problem in some of the cities, but it's not so terrible. It's not like people will kill you for a parking space like they will do in New York. You know why people in New York play such good basketball? People who grew up in New York? Because they learned how to play the man, not the ball. When somebody comes looking for a parking space, don't look for the car. Look for the guy moving towards his car, about to move out. Then you'll get a space.
That's great. So we've learned about your family, about your background. I'm looking at a book that you wrote called Battle for Our Minds, Western Elites and the Terror Threat.
Right.
When did you write this book?
I wrote it in 2012. I'd been working on it basically for years. And it was in my head. And it's really three books in one. You know my background a little bit. I'm in international affairs. I'm a political science guy. My doctorate is in political science and communications. But I was also a reporter. After I got my four degrees, and then before I got my fifth degree, I was a reporter at the New York Times, and then a reporter for...
The New York Times.
Yeah. That was when it was still a newspaper.
Yeah.
It was a great newspaper. It isn't anymore. And I learned how to write under pressure and write quickly. And I was a foreign correspondent for the Cox newspapers and a radio reporter and an editor also at the Jerusalem Post. It's very important to move in a few different ways through your life,
right?
Because otherwise you only get one perspective. And I, early on, saw that there was a terror problem that had to be discussed. There was an extreme Islamic problem that had to be discussed. And there was a problem of Western elites covering up these problems.
Yeah.
And when I speak of Western elites, I talk about three elites. Our universities.
Leftist.
Well, I don't even know if leftist is a good enough word.
Okay.
I think smug, patronizing putzes is a better word. But, okay.
I was being kind.
Right,
you're telling it the way it is.
And the same thing for the journalistic profession. It used to be that a journalist was somebody who reported the news, what happened, when did it happen, who did it, why and how. You answered those basic questions, and then you explained to the reader or the listener or the viewer why it was important for them to know this. Today, you watch journalists, and they're all about opinion.
Right.
Without fact.
Right.
And they're all about prognosticating what's going to be tomorrow without really looking at what happened today or yesterday.
Absolutely. Wow.
And I think that's a problem with our politicians also, because if you don't understand even part of your past, you're never not going to know where you're going in the future. So I say our press, our universities, and our government intelligence agencies. Now, government intelligence is like an oxymoron. It's like saying cold fire. It's a contradiction in terms, almost. And especially after 9/11, when there had been so many warnings. We had seen an uptick in terrorism, Islamic terrorism, attacks on Americans, American forces, for more than 10 years. The State Department's annual reports on the subject, even though they are laundered, even though they are modified and moderated, still showed irrefutable evidence of a basic, strong trend. And the people in power didn't want to pay attention. It's not just a Democratic thing, although I think the Democrats suffer from it more than Republicans, but the World Trade Center attack on 9/11 was the second World Trade Center attack.
Right.
The first World Trade Center attack...
93.
It was in 93, and that in many respects was a worse attack because the truck bomb, which is a Lebanese trick, the truck bomb that they placed at the pillars of the World Trade Center, had they placed it a few feet over, could have brought down one building into another and led to the deaths of, catch this, led to the deaths of 50,000 people within 3 minutes.
Wow, wow. And that's something we easily forget because we think, and, you know, look.
Just how bad it is that the people in power at the time, at the CIA, FBI, and President Clinton was president. He'd only been in office a couple months. It was early 93. But nevertheless, their attitude was, these are ad hoc bombers.
Right.
One of the leading CIA officers, Paul Pilar, described it as ad hoc terrorists and wrote a book about it saying, it'll never happen. The chance of real terrorism in the United States is like the chance of being hit by lightning. Well, we were struck twice.
Right.
And we should have known better. The fact is, they were very serious. Although it wasn't Bin Laden's organization, it was an organization almost exactly like Bin Laden's organization. It was an organization of the Muslim Brotherhood, led by Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, and our immigration services knew this guy was bad, and they let him stay in the country. And he made fun of them because they were so inept. And one of their members, actually, gave us actually an earlier chance. He murdered Rabbi Meir Kahana, who's not my hero by any means, but nevertheless, he was a human being. And he was murdered in New York City in 1990. And when they went to the guy's house, they had 15 boxes of material that included plans for landmarks in New York City, diagrams, weapons, attack angles, and materials from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Nobody knows how they got there. Well, today we know, and there was a lot of material in Arabic. They just put them aside and they never bothered reading it.
Amazing.
If they'd done that, they could have prevented the first World Trade Center attack. And they might have also gotten into the head of the terrorists. When I say it's a battle for our minds, the terrorist wins when he controls our mind. We win when we know what's in his head.
Absolutely. You're right. You know, there's a reason why we're going this direction because, number one, let me revert back just for a second. Did you serve in the Israeli Defense Force?
Yes, I did.
And that puts a different perspective on things than someone who did not.
That's right.
Because
I was in what is known as Israeli Armed Forces Radio, because I got hit by a car while doing long distance running. I couldn't be a combat soldier. I wanted to be, but I couldn't be. And in the war in Lebanon, I was the Israeli Arab Affairs reporter in Lebanon. I traveled all over Lebanon.
Wow.
Learned a lot about Lebanon, and I, of course, had studied Islam my whole life, and therefore I picked things up. You know, when you travel around Lebanon and you speak not just English and French and Hebrew, but you also have the Arabic, you can pick up a lot of stuff. People will talk to you. And they did. And that's why I'm not surprised. We live in a dangerous part of the world. But just as you can survive the dangers if you're careful, so you can defeat the dangers if you're careful.
If you're willing.
Absolutely.
If you're willing. You know, it's interesting because now I have studied the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sirah. I'm sure that you're a lot more knowledgeable than I am. But I will say, and here's what people don't understand, and first of all, Arab is a cultural term. When we can, and the reason why I use the word Muslim, Islam, because that way the world understands that Israel is on the front lines, surrounded from within and from without by those factions which seek to destroy the Jewish state, not because of land, but because of a Jewish presence.
That's right. That's right. By the way, the point was made, again, more than 20 years ago by Professor Samuel Huntington in his excellent book, Clash of Civilizations. He talked about the fact that most of the conflicts around the world were on the borders of Islam, between Muslims and non-Muslims, or between Muslims and Muslims. What we're seeing in Nigeria, in Egypt, Syria, Islam has a problem. And it's not because I'm anti-Muslim, but because I think that there are some correct principles in Islam are not always heeded by people who call themselves Muslims. And there's a tribal reality which is deeper even deeper than the religious reality. Many of the people, and we know this in the States, Mike, we've seen it. You see honor killings in California and in Missouri, in New Jersey. This thing called an honor killing is when a father or a brother sees a wife or a sister or a daughter wearing pants for the first time, or going to a movie with a guy that they don't like, or something like that, and then they murder her for the honor of the family.
Right.
Well, that's not an Islamic principle. That's a tribal principle, which says that no woman can be looked at or touched outside of the family without the permission of the father or the brother or whatever. That's not a Muslim principle. That's a tribal principle. If you will, you could see something like it with the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Right.
And the other thing is the revenge principle. If somebody does something to your tribe, your family, your clan,
right,
you forget about the law. It's us against them. And you go after them no matter what.
It's kind of like the mafia.
It's mafia also.
Right.
That's why Americans, Britons, Frenchmen, who come to the Middle East and say, oh, we'll play by the Marquis of Queensberry rules, or we'll play by Robert's Rules of Order, or we'll play by the Geneva Convention of 1949, paragraph 6, subcodicil 5. They don't know what they're talking about.
No. Wow, that's good stuff. Now, so this all led up to the book that I'm sitting here looking at now.
That's correct.
And so tell us about the book, what you've put together.
Well, I say that in order to defeat terrorism, you have to know that you're in a fight.
Now, let me ask you, I want to say this, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong.
They heard us talking about terrorism. They brought out the sirens. We can actually tell the listeners that it's not something terrible.
Right.
There's an old man next to us who slipped on the sidewalk, and he's fine. But to be safe, they brought in an ambulance, and it's very nice to see that everybody around the neighborhood stopped to take care of him.
Yeah, they even put an umbrella over him. It's very nice. They got him a chair, taking good care of him. God bless him. You know, in my studies of the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sirah, I think we've been duped into using a few terms such as extremists and things like that. And the reason for that is because from what I can see, and even historically, when I look at the life of Muhammad, he started out trying to proselytize folks, and he found out it wasn't working. So then he formed himself a little mafia and extorted, murdered, raped, and killed the whole known Arabic world at that time, and even started a practice of child brides that still continues today in a lot of Muslim countries.
That's right. Of course, you have to understand that Muhammad is a creature also of his own milieu, his own environment.
Right.
And he grew up in a tribal environment, in the tribe of Quraysh, in the Arabian Peninsula. And he was persecuted to a certain extent until he got the protection of his clan.
Okay.
And then afterwards, he got the protection of the people who became his co-religionists. And then he felt stronger, and then he did more than proselytize. I'm not interested in jumping out and criticizing him, but I think you're correct in saying that a proper respect and appreciation of Muhammad would include the bad things that he did. And we know that he had 30 different women in his life, some of them underage.
9 years old, Aisha. They have songs about him in Arabic.
That's exactly right. And the difference between the Judeo-Christian approach to Bible and the Islamic approach, or at least most Muslims' approach to Islam, is that a Jew can say, you know, Moses made a mistake or even committed a sin when he broke the stone instead of speaking to the stone.
Right.
Or the brothers of Joseph committed a sin when they threw him into the pit. When you speak to a Muslim, you can't say, you know, maybe Muhammad got it wrong on this. Oh, your life is forfeit.
Right.
You just criticized the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
Well, Muhammad was a man.
Right.
Not a god. And he had a message. And you can either agree or not agree, or agree partially with the message. And you can criticize him. And that doesn't make you evil.
Right.
And unfortunately, there's a strong approach within many Muslims that says if you talk about Muhammad at all,
negatively,
anything, your ass is grass, as we used to say. Your life is forfeit.
That's the way it ends up. So you wrote this book, and
I knew that.
Thank you, by the way, for the copy. I appreciate it. I'm definitely going to read it. I have about 10 other books from 10 other people I interviewed.
You can tell our people, the listeners, that Battle for Our Minds is available on Amazon or at Simon & Schuster.
And we'll put that link up for them to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. And or Barnes & Noble, they can get it. And if they come to Israel, I'll sign their copies.
Great. So in the book, you talk about the history, because I'm reading here, you've got, I noticed you mentioned CNN, and
we know what CNN stands for.
Communist News Network.
No, it's certainly not news.
Either way.
You know what NBC stands for?
No.
Nothing but crap. You know what ABC stands for? Anything but correct.
New acronyms.
Yeah, you know what CBS stands for? Certainly bull. And we.
Okay, got you on that one. That's good stuff. So, how did you start off writing this book as someone who's not read it?
I started it basically when I saw what happened after 9/11. And the fact that almost immediately there was a kind of preemptive charge by certain Islamic groups in the United States, like CARE and the Muslim Students Association.
Center for American Islamic Relations.
That's right.
Which is a very leftist, pro-terrorist group.
Right. And they basically are, they've been seen as unindicted co-conspirators with Hamas. And they put out a message that anybody who tried to be vigilant about Islamic terrorism was being anti-Muslim. This is not correct. The truth is that there have been people proselytizing in mosques for destroying America and Israel, committing crimes against Christians and Jews, even in Brooklyn, in New Jersey, in St. Louis, in California. And we know about this. And this wasn't the first attack. And it wasn't the last attack. And I have a real criticism of the Obama administration, which talks about hate crimes against Muslims, when actually that number of hate crimes against Jews is 6 or 7 times or 10 times the amount of crimes against Muslims
right.
in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So don't argue with the facts. The facts are clear. America doesn't have a problem with Muslims, and the world doesn't have a problem with Muslims. The world has a problem with Arab Islamic terror, which exists. It's a fact of life. And unfortunately, in the United States, where I went to school, Columbia University, they took the man who was the biggest denier of Islamic terrorism, Edward Said, a man who claimed to be a Palestinian, wasn't really. And they made him the top university professor, and they made him the authority for any kind of study of the Arab world. And here was a man, surprisingly, who barely spoke Arabic.
Wow.
He didn't know how to read or write Arabic. And he was going to tell us who was right and who was wrong to teach Arabic, Islamic history, Arab history. He was an advisor to the PLO. He criticized Arafat as not being crazy enough, which tells you something already.
Right, because Arafat was a nut job.
Arafat was a murderer. Arafat murdered 2 American diplomats and a Belgian diplomat, and the National Security Agency of the United States, heard his phone call authorizing their murder, their execution,
wow,
in an embassy in Sudan, and hid the evidence for 30 years. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
He ordered.
I've heard a lot of things about that guy since I've been here. It's crazy.
This was in January 1974, I believe, and the U.S. had information on it. They actually had the recording of him ordering the people who had taken over the embassy and captured the U.S. chargé d'affaires, Cleo Noël, and the Belgian diplomat, I forget his last name was Aïd, I forget his first name, and murdered them on Arafat, and they had the phone conversation.
Wow.
And they hid it for 30 years.
Wow.
Because some idiots at the CIA and above felt that Arafat could be an intelligence source, which of course he never was. And when the U.S. was attacked in Beirut in 82, and the U.S. embassy was blown up, and the Marines were killed, more than 200, it was Arafat working together with Hezbollah to attack these forces.
And Hezbollah is in Lebanon, just for the listeners who may not know. You know, let me say this, sir, and it's okay. We have a slight disagreement. I don't hate people, but I am very anti-Islam, and I'll tell you why. The minute you let a Muslim into your country, they're going to breed, they're going to have children. I think you need to convert them to something other than what they're at.
Oh, okay.
It's simply based on the fact that when I look at the history, I look at their charters. Not every Muslim, of course, is an Arab. They're all over Africa and Asia. We have 35 Muslim training camps, as stated by Fox News, by a Christian organization that went in and infiltrated. Now the Muslim Brotherhood wants to start a political party, which they're going to do.
It's terrible.
And Islam is being funded in the United States by Islamic countries, not just in the Arab world.
I agree with you up to a point. Let me see.
Okay.
Let's
go. I think it's good.
I think terrorists are like germs. You have to fight them. But I think there's some ways to fight germs, and there are other ways to fight germs.
Okay.
When we deal with the smallpox thing, we give it dead smallpox.
Right.
To stop aggressive Islam is to promote moderate Islam. And I'm not saying that it's the leading Islam around the world, but I know, for example, Ahmadi Islam, which has more than 70 million adherents, variations of Sufi Islam. There are various forms of Islam which are willing to live side by side with Christians and Jews.
When they're not in power.
That's right. But
we don't want Muslims in power.
I agree with you there. I agree with you there. But I think I've seen a lot of Muslim groups in the United States, this fellow Dr. Jusser and some of the others. I think they're very good people.
Now, is that the...
He's the guy who was in the Army.
Yeah.
And
I've seen his videos. What's the He has an organization, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And I've also met people...
The Clarion Report.
And I've seen other people, Dr. Kanta Ahmad, she's an Ahmadi Muslim, and they're very good people. And the Jewish perspective on this is, if you go to somebody who believes in God,
right,
believes in thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, love thy neighbor as thyself. All right, he may not believe in Jesus. He may not believe in Moses. Or he may believe that Muhammad is greater than Jesus and Moses. If he keeps the Ten Commandments and he's willing to live like my neighbor, I'm fine with that.
Even though it's a small minority out of the billions.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. And I agree with you that you have to make sure to keep your majority status.
Right.
And I think that we have to be careful and realistic when we have immigration regulations.
Right.
You don't let anybody come in from a dictatorial country and say, I'm a victim of political discrimination, when he's actually the one doing it. That's how Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman got into the United States.
Right.
He pretended he was a victim of some Egyptian regime. Yeah, right. Or some of the other people like that. You have to interview them seriously. You have to look at their sources of funding. you have to make sure they report. And yes, I agree with the New York City Police Department and not with New York's mayor. You have to have people inside their mosque listening to their sermons.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. You want to know something? Somebody wants to come to my synagogue and listen to my rabbi speech, I've got no problems with it.
No, I understand. No, it's good stuff. You know what, sir? I appreciate you. And we're out of time. We're going to have you on the show again because your book, Battle for the Minds...
You got to say it right.
Battle for Our Minds, Western Elites, and the Terror Threat. And we're going to put that up with the radio show.
Terrific.
And we want to have you back.
My pleasure.
Because you have given us a plethora of information that needs to be told.
It's my pleasure to meet you.
I want to say thank you to all those that listen to Insight to Israel, Michael. Great to have you, sir.
Thank you very
much. We're
going
to set you up another appointment and get you back on. God bless the patriot conservatives who stand for the principles of the Constitution and righteousness. And God bless Israel in her fight for sovereignty and security.
Thank you. Yeah.